One. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Welsh Republic podcast, episode 143 today. And I am here with the world famous philosopher Alexander Dugin. He is known around the world for his famous philosophical works, and he's also a bestseller in a few books he's written. Please, ladies and gentlemen, welcome Alexander. Alexander, how are you doing today?
Thank you.
So, Alexander, how's everything been in Russia, and how was your Russian Christmas? Because I know for a fact you guys in Russia, you celebrate Christmas different from the rest of the world. What have you been up to?
Well, that is not all our population, but there is one of the tradition to begin the new year with the Julian calendar, not with the Gregorian as in the West. That is secular. The Julian calendar is used mostly in church, but we have the different date for the churches. New Year, that is in the September, as ancient Jews as well used to put the beginning of the year around the equinox of the autumn. But nevertheless, the majority of Russians, they have the festival of New Year like everybody else in the world. But there is a kind of tradition as well, not too much of the church, but just old kind of old style, I would say, old style New Year that begins with at 14 January, because that coincides with the 1st January in the Julian calendar.
Mm-hmm. Did you do anything else for the holiday? Did you see family or anything like that, or?
So that is just we consider the New Year as the family festival, and for that we have holiday, and we here in the houses, we stay home, and with our close parents.
That sounds like very lovely. Here in New Zealand, we just, same New Year, I had a good New Year's too, but it was very hot here in New Zealand. It's actually quite cold here in New Zealand for New Year's. It actually usually gets very hot because it's subtropical here in New Zealand, but yeah, it is what it is. So, Alexander, tell me about yourself. So tell me, tell me about yourself. How did you get into philosophical beliefs? Like, how did you become a philosopher? Like, tell us your background, and also tell us, what is your idea of like the Eurasian kingdom, and how is that like going to work, you know, socially and economically, and what will the world be like when it's a Eurasian kingdom? So tell us about your theory about Eurasianism.
Well, that is very, very, very long story, and how to put it short, I have no idea. First of all, I would say that I consider philosophy as the not as the profession, but as spiritual vocation. So that is something that is a kind of not we who choose philosophy, but philosophy chooses us. So that is a kind of the choice, not by us, but the philosophy herself, that in some moment of the life, maybe in the youth, maybe later, strikes as the bolt strikes the human being, and everything begins to be seen in different light. So, well, you understand that you were blind, and now your eyes are finally open. You see the meanings and the senses of the things, and not the things themselves. So you arrive to understand, physically understand, that there is the another side of the reality that is really worthy of to explore, to know, to follow, to interpret, and the surface of the things is just a lie. So in beginning to be philosopher, starting to be philosopher, first of all, you separate your destiny from the majority, because you that could not be philosopher masses. So philosopher is only and isolated, not by the way of living, but by the experience of the life and of the being. So this separation produces or doesn't. So it's I would say that is the kind of event that you cannot artificially organize. So if you are invited to enter the castle without doors of real philosophy, you are there. So if you don't receive this invitation, you can go around this closed castle until the death without finding any approach, because it is totally, that is a castle without door. You could be immediately put inside, or you are obliged to go around it. That is about philosophy. So I was invited. I have received this special invitation to awaken on the other side of the world. And that was beginning of the philosophy. After that, I started to explore different philosophical system, and I was convinced that the best way to understand the philosophy is the traditionalism, because the philosophy was born in the traditional Greek society with Plato and Aristotle, and modern days traditionalists as Genon, Evola, and the other, they are still loyal to the same inspiration in the belief of God and the transcendence and the world of ideas, the world of eternity, and they despise the reality put only in time. That is illusion, pure illusion. That is why philosophy we could not separate from religion. Hegel said that philosophy is the religion plus beauty. That is great definition. So religion plus beauty, not it is not minus religion. If you are not in the religion, you could not be philosopher. So real philosophy doesn't coincide totally with religion, but without religion, no philosophy. So for me, traditionalism was the unique way to get in the depths of the philosophy, and starting to apply traditionalist principles to our historical experience, to Russian society, Russian culture, Russian identity, I have discovered that the Eurasianists that appeared, manifested in the beginning, in the 20 years of 20th century, they got closer to the truth, trying to interpret correctly Russian identity as Eurasian. It is not just the part of the Western civilization. We are a particular and independent and original civilization based on Western and Eastern elements, cemented by Christian Orthodox faith and by empire of Chinggis Khan. That is two kinds of heritage, one from the Byzantine Empire and Christianity, Orthodox Christianity, and the other influence, very important, came from the steppes, came from the Mongols, and the unification, the synthesis of Eastern and Western elements, they are in the origin of the great Russian civilization. So that was how I dedicate myself to the Eurasian vision, and that was a kind of applied traditionalism. I didn't just repeat the things Genon or Evola or Corben or other traditionalists or Mircea Eliade And the other, they already had said, I've tried to apply the principles of traditionalism to my our experience, to my country, to my state, to my culture, my history, and that the result was precisely Eurasianism. Mm-hmm.
So, Alexander, what would you say, who is your favorite when you were learning on how to be a philosopher? Who is your favorite philosopher growing up? And with your favorite philosopher, what would you say was your favorite book of his, and why was that your favorite book of his?
So I was absolutely transformed by reading Guénon, René Guénon, his three books. First of all, Reign of the Quantity, the Crisis of the Modern World, and the East and West. That was the essential, the seminal ideas of traditionalism. And after that, I've read in the early years all the other books of Guénon. I was very impressed. I was very impressed by books of Evola, Julius Evola, who has influenced very much my own ideas, except his paganism, because I'm Christian Orthodox. But as well, I was fascinated by Heidegger. I started to learn Heideggerian philosophical works precisely from the use, and after that I've explored the phenomenological tradition of Husserl, of Brentano, and I've tried to combine, to put together traditionalism and phenomenology. I see many common points there with difference of language. As well, much more later, I have discovered full-scale Platonism. So, and I've started to search inside of Platonic tradition, Neoplatonic tradition, and Aristotelism. Some people think wrongly that Aristotle is a quite full opposition to Plato. That is very superficial opinion and wrong, because they, in the essential points, they are together. They are very, very complementary. Aristotle placed, emphasizes, I would say, the imminent horizon of the reality, and the Plato transcendental. But to put together, they create all kind of traditional philosophy, and that was another source of inspiration of this Republic of Plato and the Treaty on the Soul of Aristotle. So, together with traditionalists and work of them, and together with phenomenology, as well as with structuralism. Some time I have dedicated to study structuralism of Levi-Strauss, of Trubetskoy, who was the founder of, by the way, of Eurasian movement in the 20s and 30s of previous century, as well as of Dumézil and many others. So, the key to understand Islamic mystical tradition and Iranian tradition in general was very dear author Henri Corbin, whose work on the imagination of the Ibn Arabi has produced on me the great effect in the youth as well. So I am always surrounded by the high circle of the genius, and I'm living, speaking with them, discussing with them, trying to understand what one of them said on different occasions. So I am totally engaged in this philosophical symposium with the great mind, because they have left behind them the treasuries of their philosophical inspiration and revelation, and all that obviously based on the Christian tradition, because I see in the most Christian Orthodox authorities in the Dionysius of Areopagite, in the Maxim, the Confessors, and Simeon, Neo Theologian, and Gregory of Palama, and many, many of them in the Christian Orthodox tradition, I see the parallel line of the development of the very important metaphysical approach. And with the help of Plato, Aristotle, traditionalism, phenomenology, and structuralism, I try to make all this open to penetrate the hidden sense of all these authors and schools and tendencies that help to enter inside of their inner dimension.
So, Alexander, I also read here that you are able to speak Italian, German, French, English, and Spanish. Wow, that's a lot of language. When you were learning how to speak languages, what would you say is like your favorite language out of all of them, and the one that sounds the most beautiful, and the one that really you'd say speaks to humanity the most?
So indeed, I know more or less not so well these languages. I could read and speak and understand them, but I would say that, for example, philosophy, I prefer to read in German, including sometimes when I know French better than German, but when it affects the philosophy, I from time to time I use German translation of the French thinkers in order to understand better, because the German language doesn't let any ambiguity to exist. So if German translator doesn't understand some passage of French author, it could not go further. So the Germans cannot lie. That is the language that cannot lie. So German language always says truth, or something that Germans say it is. It is not necessary truth, but it is for sure that Germans themselves believe that what they say, that is true. So that is open language, philosophically open. It has no backstage. That is in comparison with French. So French is very elusive. And at the same time, because I started to learn languages with René Guénon, so French language is for myself as well the kind of intellectual language, and I think from time to time in French when I'm dealing with complicated rational issues, because this language that is Latin, obviously. The kind of Latin, it is very very useful in order to construct rational buildings with complicated issues, not maybe so clear and direct as the German, but in a different way. So the beauty of the sounds, I prefer Portuguese. So I am great fan of Brazilian music. So I think that that's something absolutely charming in Portuguese. And I the other Latin language, Italian, I like very much, because it is something between, philosophically, it's something between French and German. So it is much more clear. So in Italy, you could not hide so easily as in French what you want to, what are you going to say. So it is closer to German and English language. So what we use, what we know as English, is not English. There's parallel simulacrum of English. The real English language, it is almost two and a half languages. You have almost all Roman roots and Roman expressions after the William the Conqueror. So you have Anglo-Saxon German set of roots and a bit of Celts infiltrations. So if, for example, open English literature made mostly by Celts, by Ireland's Ireland men, for example, Yeats, Wilde, and the others. So that is a really important thing. This Irish people are much more inclined to the beauty of the language, but nevertheless, English language can be beautiful as well, and it's useful to speak on the international level to everybody. It is now used as a kind of pseudo language of the globalism, but we can easily, I presume, to restore its dignity if we try to read the real romance, the real poetry, to real text on it, including starting from Chaucer or Shakespeare and the other. That is great language. So it is now is victim of the global thrash trying to speak English, but the reality of this language is very beautiful and today almost forgotten.
You're right.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, Alexander, every time I hear the French language and Italian language, I can only just think of food. It makes me think of food. You know, like, because of how delicious it can be and like, that's what it thinks. So, Alexander, the Western media likes to portray you as like, they say that you're the world's most, so basically it says here, cosmo-liberals in some of these countries, like United States and the West, say you're the most dangerous philosopher in the world, which I know is a load of rubbish. And then they say that you're the right man to, like, you're one of Putin's advisors. So tell me, like, what is your opinion to that claim of them saying that? And what is it like to work with Vladimir Putin? And sorry, what is it like to work with Vladimir Putin? And what do you think makes him like one of the best leaders in the world right now? And what do you think with him, what he's done to Russia, taking Russia from a third world country to an economic prosperous nation that has a great future ahead of it?
So first of all, I could not judge my name or most dangerous philosopher. If my enemies think so, maybe it is. I would be happy to correspond to this description. Nothing personal, but I hate globalism. I hate liberalism. I hate modern and postmodern civilization and Western hegemony openly, and I have built all my work all in my life in very different domain, the philosophy, the politology, and the geopolitics, based on this rejection of the pretension of the modern West on universality. And I have done that in a systematic way. So I have dedicated to the criticism of the Western sociological tradition, anthropology, economy, politics, geopolitics, anthropology, culture, politology, so religion, philosophy. So I am attacking still now the Western paradigm, modern, above all, Western modernity started with the end of the Middle Ages of the West is very attractive, in my opinion. So I have nothing against that. So I'm in favor of the pre-modern Western tradition, sacred tradition of the West that I am very fascinated by. But I radically, as the other traditionalists, I radically reject I radically reject the Western modernity and its culmination in the liberal globalist transhuman, transgender politics and culture of the present West. So I don't know how it judges myself, but I judge the modern the Western modernity as the civilization of devil, and I have no I could not imagine any compromise with the devil. So I am fighting it openly and consciously, and I know what I'm doing. So if the West pays to me the same money, the same price, that would be quite logical. And that is why I am a supporter of Putin, who maybe in spite of himself has challenged the Western hegemony, made return to traditional values and starts to create multipolar system instead of the unipolar that was that has appeared after the fall of the Soviet Union. So in the 90s, we were almost the province of the West, the colony of the West in any senses, ideologically, first of all, economically, politically, culturally. And that was the great fall of Russian history and betrayal of our identity. All these pro-Western politicians of the 90s and the late 80s, I consider to be historical criminals that betrayed Russian history. And we blame with all our society, now we blame them, absolutely. And Putin was in this line, this chain of the leaders, a kind of miracle, a kind of savior of Russian independence. And he is the God's given leader that transformed the dominating tendency of the fall and total decline and disappearance of our country, and started from first step in his position to improve the situation. But at the same time, I am not at all his advisor. I am just his fan, I would say. I am following him. He is not just my president. He is my leader. And I think that I am not alone. The absolute majority of Russian thinks the same way. So I think my ideas are more or less known on the top level of our society already from the 90s. But in the 90s, that was the mostly military circles and special services that shared my anti-Western and pro-Russian position, and that went against the elite, not against the people or society, against the liberal Western traitors, fifth column. That is why I was marginalized and criticized and demonized during the 90s in my own country, but with Putin, that started to change. I'm not in favor to all Putin's moves and decisions. And from time to time, I openly and sincerely criticize some of them. But in generally, I think he is a real historic leader that now is hardly fights for dignity and independence and sovereignty, or not only of Russia as the state, but as Russia as a civilization and culture. So, and it is clear that to enemy of all that, for the people who hate tradition, sacredness, religion, Christianity, hierarchy, power, deep identity, the original sacred culture, so they should hate us both, myself as intellectual and Putin as the political leader. And if on the level of the matter of the body of the sensible reality, I think he's much more hated, But on the level of the ideas, I think I'm much more than himself. But it is my opinion.
So, Alexander, as we all know, we have the war going on in Gaza at the moment, which is poor Palestinians, been them being killed, the justice that has been committed against them for 75 years, which is just absolutely terrible. What is, with especially also with the Ukrainian war going on at the moment, with these two wars that are going on, what is your vision for like the new world, especially knowing that like China and Russia, potentially China will probably be the world superpower? How do you think the new world is going to look like, that this new multipolar world, like philosophically, and how, and like, do you, and what would it be like, how do you think China and Russia will be like with being the world's leading superpowers going forward? Like, how do you see it?
First of all, we are living at the beginning of 2024 in the moment of intersection of two waves, of two global waves, two most important waves. The first wave is the decline of the Western hegemony. That arrived at its culmination in the 90s when Charles Krauthammer has declared that we are living in the unipolar moment. This unipolar moment achieved its peak, its height at 9/11, and after that began the general decline of the Western hegemony. So the unipolarity is on decline. That is, but it is still here. It is represented in the Western coalition, in the Biden administration, and the EU liberals in the coalition against Russia and Ukraine, in total support, almost total support for Israel in Gaza. So the West is here. The West is in a decline, but it is still here. And it pretends to be the unique setter of the rules on the world scale. So that is the declining wave, but it is very strong, still very strong. And we see the kind of will, the agonic will of the globalists elite on the world scale, not to let a multipolar alternative world order to appear. So that is the fight. Now we are inside of the fight, and the Ukraine is just one of the front, as you correctly have said, of this war between two waves. First wave is the declining a wave of the global domination of the unipolar West, and the alternative emerging wave, it is the wave of multipolarity. It is not this time only Russia against the West. It is Russia, China, Islam as civilization, maybe India, partly Africa and Latin America. So this emerging, growing multipolar wave is represented by BRICS, for example. So, and we could suggest logically that there will be more fronts between two waves. So if the waves intersect, for example, now clearly in two cases, in the Ukraine, the Western coalition against Russia, Ukraine count nothing, just the territory of the conflict between collective West against Russia. We consider Ukraine to be part of our civilization. We could accept it on the term of the neutrality, total neutrality, as the bridge between us and Europe. But the globalists, they want this territory for themselves uniquely, without sharing with us any influence. And it's so that the conflict was inevitable, and that is the iron law and not the subjective decision of Putin that led to the conflict, geopolitical conflict in Ukraine. The second front now is open in the autumn of 2023 in Gaza, so with Hamas terrorist attack against Israeli and great genocide that started after words with idea to eradicate all the Palestinian population from the Israel. That is the concept of Great Israel, dear to some radical Zionists in the Israel, and the West once more was on the side of the Israel. So that was consolidation of the West for Israel and against Palestinians, against Islam in the general. They don't say that openly, but the behavior of the West, of the Biden, that shows clearly. So that is second point. And I think that Yemenis, Houthi now, and maybe Hezbollah tomorrow and Iran the day after tomorrow, they will enlarge this front in the Middle East that will affect Syria and Iraq and other territories. So we, this front is just the beginning of the huge war between Islam and unipolarity. And Israel, that will be the price for that. And I can easily imagine the end of the Israel as it is now, if the Islamic country will organize the real and solidary resistance, and they are fighting for Islamic civilization to be one more pole on the global in the global system. I think that we could this year as well have the other fronts. For example, the front in the China, you know, to some days ago in the Taiwan, anti-Chinese fraction, pro-Western globalist party has won elections. And I think now hostility will grow. So I presume that there will be new front line as well. The conflict between North Korea and South Korea, we cannot exclude, and situation is as well aggravating there. So that will be Asian, South Asian front between the other pole of civilization, China, of multipolarity, against the same West, because South Korea, it is not the sovereign player, it's just a proxy as Israel or Ukraine of the United States. We can as well imagine the conflict between Venezuela and Guyana in Essequibo, in that region, because Guyana was created by Atlanticists, and that is just the part of British colonialism, and the legitimate claim of the Maduro, it could easily lead to new front, or maybe this strange president of Argentina can open the front with Malvinas. To finish the enumeration, the possible front line between multipolarity, multipolar wave, and unipolar wave, we could easily imagine the war between anti-colonial Western African countries as Mali, Central African Republic, Burkina Faso, and Gabon against, for example, pro-Western, pro-colonial power countries, as for example, Nigeria, with the inner conflicts opening, because in Nigeria there was the terrible civil war with Biafra and with Igbo ethnicity. All that could start in this year, because the declining wave doesn't want to recognize multipolarity and doesn't let to multipolar wave to appear peacefully. So, and the blame and the responsibility of all these wars, including in Ukraine, is totally on the side of the collective globalist West that doesn't want to recognize its own decline.
Absolutely. How I look at it, Alexander, is I do think the West is going to lose a lot of these wars. I think, you know, Ukraine is about to lose their war. I think Israel probably is going to disappear soon. And yeah, that's, and I also think China would defeat United States in a war in Taiwan. But talking about that, Alexander, I saw a very good Twitter post of yours. And everybody right now is mentioning this about the future of America. So you said the other day that on a tweet, the West can be saved only by civil war, because of the West being misrepresented by the globalist elite. Some people say it's the Rothschild banking cartel who controls the West. Many people have different opinions. Alexander, when you look at America 20 years from now, okay, so first question here, how do you think that civil war in the United States will start? Do you think it will be, by the way, I'm not a supporter of Donald Trump. I don't support him, but whether you don't like him or not, he's got a huge following. When you look at Donald Trump right now, do you think it will be him being put in jail, or do you think he'll be assassinated? And how do you think, what do you think the civil war in America would look like? And then after the Civil War, knowing after the West has collapsed and lost its dominance, what do you think America will be in 20 years? Because some people say America should be like a socialist country. So there's a guy called Haas, for instance. He's a, you probably heard of him, Haas, and he believes that America should be a socialist country because he's seen the success that socialism has done with China. So what do you think, like, how do you think the Civil War will start? What do you think it will look like? And where do you see America 20 years from now?
First of all, I would say that we need from the beginning to set the same frames to our vision of the future. So there are two Wests. There is not only one West, but there are two Wests. One West is represented, we can call it actual West. The actual West, West number one, is represented by globalist liberal elite, by Biden's administration, by Blinken, by Democrats, by Rothschild, by Federal Reserve's system. So that is the globalist West that could not tolerate not to be unique, not to be dominant, not to be hegemonic, not to be unique capital of the world. So that is globalism. There is nothing against the West. Everything is either West, other we should fight against that. So the global West represented by global elite, not necessarily they should be Anglo-Saxon, French, or German, or Jews. They could be of any color of skin. They could be African, but they should be globalists. So globalist, for example, as Sunak, Rishi Sunak is Hindu, but being Hindu, yeah, he is totally Anglo-Saxon, liberal, globalist kind of person. So he's more Anglo-Saxon than many other Anglo-Saxons. So that is not about the ethnicity. Global West, it is about the form of the rule based on liberal ideology, sexual gender politics, artificial intelligence, and technocracy. So there is the West. And this West is in decline and in agony. So it tries to exist, and it tries to fight multipolarity at any price. So that is suicidal, extremist, totalitarian West. That is already here, and that is actual West. That is Orwellian West, not socialist, but liberal capitalist West. That is pure totalitarian regime of third type. There was first totalitarianism, Soviet communist, there was second totalitarianism, fascist, and there is third, liberal totalitarianism. And there is another West, the West that is potential, the West number two, that represent, I presume, majority of the Western people, society, of majority of the men living in the West, Western or not, they don't want absolutely this suicidal politics. They are obliged, and the totalitarian rulers and the communism I have lived I lived in the communism. I know what costs the individual opinion. Nothing. So individual opinion in modern days, liberal, globalist, totalitarian of some people who disagree with them costs nothing at all. So they could be regarded as non-existent and being at the same time the majority. So this silent majority of the not liberal, not globalist West, I think that is the other West, the West number two, that could potentially accept multipolarity, defending Western values, Western culture, but inside the system based on the recognition of the validity and the legitimacy of other civilizations. So between them, there will be the war, but not between us and the West. Between us and the West, the war is already going. There will be the new kind of the war inside of the West. So Western civil war. We could see the elements of that in the Europe, but if we are speaking about United States, I think that in spite of himself, the Trump, and more than that, Trumpism, in Trumpism we trust, not so much in Trump, but in Trumpism we trust. The Trumpism is a kind of new symbol of point of coordination, of intersection of many different, absolutely opposite groups of people in the United States. They are united only by the rejection of the rule of these globalist democratic elites. I think that the majority of Republican Party is on the right, and some elements, as for example Kennedy and other isolated person in the Democratic Party as well, share this general opinion against globalism. So if the situation will aggravate, if they, for example, Biden falling down the old, totally mad, totally stupid old man, considering that Trump is in very, very better form during the election, they could decide this beast, apocalyptic beast that represent the globalist rule, could decide to kill Trump. And I presume it could be the start of the civil war in the United States as well. I think we see what is going in Texas. In Texas, the state powers, they decided to stop uncontrolled immigration on their territory, taking the control against the federal government of the part of the border with Mexicans. So something like that could make the United States to explode. And I think it is logically inevitable between these two Wests, West number one and West number two, there is no dialogue. The West number one, in the totalitarian style, pretends that there is no West number one. There is only West. There is no the West number two. There is nobody except the globalists themselves and their total control. They don't recognize the other inside, outside. They don't recognize the other outside in the multipolarity, in the plurality of the civilizations, and they don't recognize the other inside of them. So they are absolutely fanatic, extremist, crazy, and they have the rule over the West. That is very dangerous. And there is the second, the West of Trumpist, of all kind of people who just don't share with the globalist day agenda. They could easily accept multipolarity and they could prosper and live as they want without global hegemony, just occupying of their problem. But if Trump, for example, wins, if he manages to not be killed by these crazy old perverts and junkies, so and transgenders, So he could avoid the civil war. So if Trump wins, if the much more normal politicians in the West than present day, not pro-Western, very with dignity and responsibility of their own tradition, but accepting multipolar rules, if they win in Europe, in the United States, civil war could be avoided. But I have maybe only in the United States with Trump, there is small chance that they could win legitimately. And maybe the globalists would start in their turn the civil war. So because they are losing everything, so they will be judged, they will be hanged. The people like who will survive all that, the people like Blinken and Kamala Harris, they will be hanged on the trees. They will be tortured because what they have done to their country, to their civilization, to the people, starting the bloody wars, helping to the terrorist organization to kill, to organize genocide in Gaza, mass killing of people in Ukraine. So they should take responsibility on day. They will be judged and killed, all of them, all globalists. So they are in the corner. They could not let the normal powers to win because they will be obliged to respond on for their atrocities and crimes. So I think they could start as well civil war. So in the Europe as well, I see no elements of the peaceful transition from the West number one to the West number two, because the or dialogue between them, not necessarily there will be alternative West number two that should win. It would be very good for all humanity, for the West itself. But the West number one cannot just begin the dialogue with the West number two, because they immediately blame the West number two to be Putin's agents, to be fascists, to be extremists, to be anti-feminists and anti-Semites and all other things. So I think that I would be happy if the West could avoid civil war, but it is very, very unlikely.
Mm-hmm. So, Alexander, right now, as we all know, the Court of South Africa, the ICJ Court, is holding the apartheid state of Israel guilty for their crimes they've committed against the Palestine, which is brilliant that South Africa is doing that. Why? I've got two questions. Why is it that Russia is kind of in the middle of it, not siding with it, especially China too with that? And how do you see that court case going? Do you think they will find Israel guilty or not? How do you see it going?
So, first of all, I am absolutely sure that is symbolic action, very important and very, 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 very serious question to blame the killers, the perpetrators of genocide. And that is kind of the show of the iron will to defend the laws and the principles of the humanity against the global dictatorship that is already here. So I appreciate very much the decision of the South and Africa. I think Russia is more or less shares the same position. Maybe Russia, but you should understand, we have our own war. Now we have our own war. The problem of the Palestinians and Houthi should be resolved. The problem of the challenge of Israel should be responded by Islamic civilization. We could not afford more war. We have our own war, and we are going to win it. And that that demands from us all kind of concentration of all powers, of all potentials, of all resources. We could not artificially create new front line. We just could not afford that. So we are not in the brilliant position. We are winning, but it is not yet the victory. The real victory will follow after the fall of the Kyiv. So and we are concentrated to do that. So we could not permit to ourselves to enter to the war and to blame Israel and to say that there is genocide. And I think that is clear challenge to the West, not to the Israel. Israel is just the part of the West. So I think that is now, I sincerely am convinced that now is the turn of the Islamic countries to show their colors, because they blame the West, they criticize the West. But when the moment comes to defend their brothers in faith, some of them, as Bahrain, join anti-Houthi coalition, that is despicable. I think that Emir of Bahrain is as good as dead now, because he will be obliged to be responsible for his actions, because of the pure betrayal of joining a Western coalition against Yemen. It is pure act of the betrayal. But I think now that now is the turn of the Islam to deal with Israel and to deal with the West. We are fighting our own war against the West in Ukraine. Now I think that is the moment to fight Islamic war against the West in the Palestine and Gaza, and Islamic world refuses to do that. So we are not in the position to change the balance in this situation. We are not second pole, we are just one of the multiple poles fighting radically for our sovereignty and for our revival. We are not in the position to lead a new war, and this war should be led by Islamic countries themselves. And that is very, very symbolic that Southern Africa is siding with the just cause and that genocide, defending poor Palestinians killed every minute. We are speaking now, and the Palestinian babies are killed, and women's and men's, and the civilians, and they are killed, and they are killed, and they will be killed. And I think that Israel, under our eyes, is losing its moral position in the world that was a kind of compassion to them after the Second World War. View the victims of the terrible and horrible politics of the Hitler and Nazi Germany persecuting Jews. Now the Jews are in the positions of the butchers. They are now in the position of Nazi, killing the other, declaring
the Zionists.
Zionists. So I think that is a great change now. So those who were considered to be victims, a kind of eternal victims, and that all our sympathy was on the side of these people suffered so severely during Second World War, they now are showing totally different image of themselves. So I think that is irreversible. So Israel never will be the same as before, and I think that it's quite possible that the modern Israel will cease to exist in some future.
Alexander, so before we finish up, I just wanted to ask you one more question. Do you have anything else you would like to share to the audience?
The name of your broadcasting, your podcast was Welsh Republic. I think that I presumed that we spend some time to speak about that. I have written the book on the history of Britain and the culture of Britain and the philosophy of Britain. That is called England or Britain. It is just a question. So the name of my book is Question, Britain or England? So in my opinion, there are two Britains. There are Celtic, Britain, and that is German, Anglo-Saxon, England. And red and white dragon, as they indicate in the first myths of King Arthur and Merlin, magician Merlin. So I think these two archetypes are still fighting inside of modern England. There is the kind of Celtic pole inside. Oh, not only Scotland, not only Ireland, Irish people, not only Welsh or that, but as well, there is inside of English population, English society, a kind of Irish, Brits, original elements. And there is totally different, totally opposing German elements. And they are still fighting. These two dragons are still fighting. And I think that now the England demonstrates its wars quality, imperialism, hegemony, tricks, lies, and I presume why not to use the moment of the decline of the globalism, and globalism was English concept, and that was English Empire, not so much Britain Empire. Why not to use this decline of the global idea of the English hegemony, English domination, as in Cecil Rhodes' version of imperialism? Why not to use this moment to rearrange the fight between two dragons? Why not to awaken red dragons, Brits, original Irish, we can say Celtic identity, in order to reverse the history. So during the Cromwell, during the English Revolution, and after that, Celtic people suffered so much from Englishmen. So maybe just turn the weight of the balance in a different way. So let's consider the Irish population, the Celtic population of English islands to be the part of the West, number two, of the multipolar West, and to be the kind of allies of the multipolar world. So that is my suggestion. That's what I would like to say to audience, precisely those who are interested in this kind of Celtic, Brit, Welsh identity, I would say.
Yeah. Thank you for coming on, Alexander. It was a pleasure to have you. I really enjoyed this interview. Where can people find you, Alexander?
So I have a Twitter account, Agade Chen, A-G-D Chain, and the same name in the Telegram social service, so you can follow that if you want. And if you're interested in the depths of my thought, I have 4pt.su site with the theoretical works in different languages, and geopolitica.ru, the site where I'm publishing my geopolitical analysis.
Well, thank you for coming on, Alexander. It was a pleasure having you. Please, ladies and gentlemen, go and check out Alexander's work and go check out his books and his websites. He's one of the most talented philosophical people in the history of humanity. You'll learn so much from him about Russian history and about philosophical beliefs. So yeah, go follow him on Twitter, go support his work. And please, everyone, remember to share the Welsh Republic podcast, episode 144. Remember to give this a like and subscribe. Yeah, take care, everyone. God bless you all. Stay safe. Bye.